very much for inviting me, and thank you very much for coming. There's only one thing I think that everybody knows about Isaac Newton, and that is that he watched an apple fall from a tree. They don't know what it means, but they know that that's important. And this is the stamp that was published in 1987, that's the 300th anniversary of the book I'm going to be talking about in Latin, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. And you can see, again, there's an apple on the stamp, because the apple has become an icon of Newton, rather like saints have attributes. So St. Catherine's got a wheel, or St. Jerome has got a lion. Well, Newton is like a secular saint who has an apple. It's become so symbolic of him that there's pictures of it all over the world. So this is a picture from 19th century Japan. There was a change of regime in the middle of the 19th century in Japan, and the Department of Education produced posters like this to inspire school children and university students to learn about Western science. So this is their version of Newton sitting beneath a very Japanese-looking apple tree. And a more recent example is at the end of the 20th century, there was an astronomical institute was built in India. And you can see this is a rather Indian-looking statue of Newton. And they wanted an apple tree, but apple trees, unfortunately, don't really like the climate very much in India. So they imported all sorts of helium lamps and shields, and eventually, they got an apple to grow, and apparently became a pilgrimage site from Bombay, which is about 200 miles away. So this is how important the apple is to us. And you might, seeing you're at Cambridge, want to make a pilgrimage to Woolsthorpe, which is by car about an hour and a half up the A14. And that is supposedly the original apple tree that he is supposed to have sat under and been inspired. So did this really happen? Did he really watch an apple fall in the garden in Woolsthorpe? He never said anything about it until about 4 or 5 years before he died. And then, when he was about 80, he told it to 4 different people. And the most famous version is by William Stukeley, who was an expert on Stonehenge and quite a lot younger than him. And this is the account that Stukeley gave. The notion of gravitation was occasioned by the fall of an apple as Newton sat in a contemplative mood. Why should that apple always descend perpendicularly to the ground, thought he to himself. Why should it not go sideways or upwards, but constantly to the Earth's centre? Assuredly, the reason is that the Earth draws it. There's a power like that we here call gravity, which extends itself through the universe. I think to us that sort of thing is so obvious, so second nature. We've all been brought up in to understand that the universe is Newtonian. So I want to go back and think a bit what it would have meant to Newton and to his contemporaries. For one thing, as those of you who were here for the Edwards talk, as you'll know that in there's a famous apple at the beginning of the book of Genesis. And that would have undoubtedly occurred to Newton and his contemporaries immediately, that an apple falling from a tree is symbolically, it's the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and it represents the fall of mankind in the Garden of Eden. So, and people were absolutely steeped in biblical and religious imagery. And that's the first thing that would have occurred to them. Another thing that would have occurred to them is that Newton said, there's the same power that brings the apple to the ground as makes the moon go around the Earth. And again, that seems absolutely common sense to us, but wouldn't necessarily have seemed that way to people in the 16th and early 17th centuries who had learnt about an Aristotelian model of the universe when they were at school. So this is an Aristotelian cosmos. So there's the Earth at the centre, and there's the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun going around the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and then there's various other outer spheres, which we don't need to talk about now. But the whole point of this model of the universe is that out in the heavens, everything is divine and perfect and unchanging. And that's why you've got circular orbits, because circular's an emblem of divine perfection. And there's only one element out there called the ether. And that everything out there is permanent, unchanging. When you come into the Earth in the centre, the laws are completely different. Everything is corrupt, it's degenerating, and it's changing. So the idea that the same power should be acting in the heavens as acting on the earth was something that's instinctive to us, but not necessarily instinctive for Newton's contemporaries. The third way I think his understanding differed from ours is it's called the mathematical principles of natural philosophy. And for us, maths is absolutely integral to physics. But historically, mathematics and natural philosophy were different. Mathematicians provide a model of the universe. So for example, when Copernicus said that the Earth goes round the Sun, most of his contemporaries didn't really mind whether the Earth went round the Sun or vice versa. They just saw that as a model of the universe that worked better than previous models. So mathematicians aren't necessarily interested in what's out there. Natural philosophers, on the other hand, are looking for explanations. And sort of before roughly the 16th century, natural philosophers did not incorporate mathematics in their analyses of what's happening in the universe. So the third thing that Newton did was bring together mathematics and natural philosophy. So I'm going to divide this talk into three parts. Newton's life and achievements, the Principia and Isaac Newton, and the Principia and Newtonianism. And there's sort of two things which I really want to emphasise during this talk. Firstly, you can't separate out the Principia from the rest of Newton's life and achievements. By now it's by far his most famous book, but to think about the Principia, you have to think a bit about his life and other books. There's some seats at the front, which is the penalty for coming late. You have to sit at the front. But there's some seats there while you'd be nice and far away from it, so it won't be too bad. The other really, really important thing is that Newton didn't do this alone. It's very tempting to think that there was this sort of prehistoric world where people were really stupid and thought the Earth, sun went round the Earth and everything was different. And then suddenly, hey presto, Newton sat under the apple tree, published the Principia, and everything changed. It's not like that at all. There was no sudden transition. Newton had lots of predecessors and lots of followers, and I'm going to be stressing that in the talk. So I'll start by talking a bit about Newton himself. When you write an account of somebody, a biography, there's basically two ways of doing it. You can do it thematically by, I don't know, gravity, optics, and things like that. And that's what I'm going to be talking about here. This is Newton's monument in Westminster Abbey, and I'm going to come to that in a minute. The other way of writing a biography is what's often called a cradle-to-grave account. You start at the beginning where they were born, and you just go through their life. And I put this map up to show that basically Newton only lived in three places. He studied in Cambridge. He was born in Woolsthorpe and went to school at Grantham, and he lived a lot of his life in London. And really, he didn't go anywhere else. He didn't even go to Oxford. So, and he certainly never went abroad. So if you think of those three places, you can divide his life up quite nicely into phases according to where he was living. So he was brought up at Woolsthorpe and Grantham, where he went to school. And then he came to Trinity as an undergraduate, and then there were various outbreaks of plague, and so it's much safer to be in the countryside than to be in a big city like Cambridge. And so he went back to Woolsthorpe, and it's in the first of those interludes that he's said to have the great inspiration that he watched the apple fall from the tree and did his experiments with prisms. And that 66 to 67 is often called his Annus Mirabilis, his miraculous year. So then he came back to Trinity, and he was a fellow. 1687 he published the Principia, but he stayed here till 1696 when he had a sort of nervous breakdown. And then he went to London, and you can see there's 30 years in London. It was a large section of his life, and it's a part of his life that people often forget about, but was actually very important. So that's the sort of broad outline of his life. And you have to remember, although Grantham and Woolsthorpe are only an hour and a half up the A14. It took him 2 or 3 days to get here by horseback. So this is the monument at Westminster Abbey. You can see it if you go there. And I'm going to talk about different sections of it. And I'm going to start with this plaque underneath. And you probably can't very see terribly clearly, but there's little cherubs on that plaque. And some of them are doing chemical experiments, and some of them are carrying coins. So I'm going to start by explaining the plaque. You have to remember this was the monument that was erected in 1727 when he died, and this in a way represents how people thought about Isaac Newton at the time, not how we think about him now. It's a tribute to his life as it was perceived in that in those days. So this is some of the innovations that Newton introduced at the Mint, and he was at the Mint for about 30 years. He ran it for quite a lot of that time. And the Mint might seem completely separate from physics, but it's not. For one thing, you can see he introduced machines like this. The basic idea is that you turn that great lever, and there's a guy sitting there, and he puts in blank coins underneath, and this comes down and presses a pattern onto one side, then you turn the coins over and put a different pattern on the other side. And Newton prided himself on being very, very efficient, and he introduced lots of machinery to make the coin production work quicker. And there were very, very close links between Newtonian natural philosophy and the commercial development of Britain during the 18th century. We often think of physics as being sort of very abstract and dry, but it was one of the ways in which natural philosophers could promote what they were doing was by pointing out the financial advantages. The other reason why his activities at the Mint were related to his physics is because one of his fundamental assumptions is that the law of gravity is universal. It's the same right through the universe. So the law of gravity is the same in London as it is in Africa, where the gold was coming from, and therefore gold weighs the same in Africa as it weighs here. And gold coins actually weighed what they represent, the financial value. They weren't tokens like money is now. So the physics that he did was important for his work at the Mint in two different ways. The little cherubs on the plaque were also doing chemistry. And I think it's very tempting to think of Newton as sort of an abstract man sitting there with a pencil and paper having great ideas. He was actually very, very practical. He ground lenses for telescopes. On the left, a whole load of furnaces. That's his drawing of furnaces. And he built them himself to carry out chemical and alchemical experiments. He wrote more about alchemy than he did about anything else. He's left masses and masses and masses of alchemical manuscripts. And it is quite clear that the alchemical work that he did was very central to his ideas about physics. So these are some of the alchemist symbols. So that's gold, and that's the symbol for the sun. Under the Aristotelian system, the sun is hot and dry, and it's like men's brains, so it's a masculine planet. Masculine planet under the Aristotelian system. Silver is related to the moon, and it's related to women. Women's brains under the Aristotelian system are all cold and wet, which is why they can't think very well. So, well, it's sort of easy to sort of dismiss alchemy as being absolute rubbish. In fact, you can think of alchemists as being on a spectrum with Newton right up at the top end. And it's all about change in the world. If you think about the world, you have things like you plant an acorn and it turns into an oak tree. You have a baby and it grows up. You have an iron cross on the top of a church. It becomes magnetic. Everything is changing. And for Newton's contemporaries, a lot of them thought of themselves as related to the universe. So when alchemists wanted to change lead, a base metal, into gold, a superior metal, in the same way, Newton thought that by praying and dedicating himself to God, he could refine his own soul. So he saw his alchemy as a chemical pursuit, but also as a spiritual pursuit. Going back to the monument, you can see that here, Newton is leaning his elbow on four books, and all four of them are very significant. The first one, and you can tell that it's got the names on the spines. The first one is the Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms. So you see here, this is the Urania, the goddess of astronomy. And it was very typical to represent sciences like astronomy or maths or reason by women, even though women had these cool wet brains and couldn't actually do any of it. The sciences were always represented by women. So that's Urania. And that's a celestial globe underneath. That it shows the pattern of the comets that Newton studied, but it also shows the type of the constellations at the time of the voyage of the Argonauts. And that relates to his interest in the chronology of ancient kingdoms in Egypt and Greece, because what he was trying to do was to relate astronomical history to human history, and he used astronomical events to date events in history. So it was another reason for him why he was interested in astronomy. One of the other books is Observations on the Prophecies of Daniel. He made all sorts of prophecies that the world was coming to an end. So far we've survived all of them, but we haven't actually got to 2060 yet, so perhaps you'll be right about that one. His Bible, his whole library, is in the university library. And if you look at his copy of the Bible, you can see that the book that he read most was the book of Daniel. He was absolutely preoccupied with the book and with numerical prophecies. Right, this is perhaps what we now think of as a more scientific book, Optics. And he published that in 1704, after he'd left Cambridge and when he was in London. And it's no coincidence, he published it the year after Robert Hooke died. Robert Hooke was his great rival. Robert Hooke always accused him of plagiarism. He accused him of pinching his ideas on light and pinching his ideas on gravity. So this book came out in English after Hooke died, and it's not so much a book announcing new discoveries, it's more like a manifesto. It presents his previous results and talks about the virtue of experiment. And it was for his experiments in optics that Newton first became famous. So this is a 19th century very romanticised picture. You see, he's in his room, and those are the shutters on the windows, and he's closed the shutters and made a small hole, and the sun comes through and goes into a rainbow-coloured spectrum. That actually is not particularly significant. Everybody could do that. But the whole point of Newton's experiment was to... There's a seat there. Was to refute the previous theory of light. This theory of light had been put forward by Descartes. From Descartes we get the adjective Cartesian. And Descartes' idea was that when light shines through something, like through a piece of coloured glass, the light changes in property because it goes through that medium, the water or the glass or whatever it happens to be. So that's why it's called modification, because the light is modified or changed by the medium. And what Newton did was show that that is not the case. And this is his own sketch of how he did that. So it's the other way around. The window shutter is here. There's a small beam of light. Here's the sunlight coming through. And here's a prism. And so you have to imagine, if you think of the previous picture I showed you, this is the coloured rainbow here being displayed on this screen. The really important bit about this experiment is that he had a second prism. So he had little holes in the screen. So here, one single colour of light went through. A single colour went through, and it went through the prism up there. And when it got up there to the top, it was exactly the same colour as it had been here. So that proved that it wasn't the glass that was changing the colour of the light. The glass had no effect on the colour of the light. It proved that all the different colours were in the sunlight originally. So that was one of his major experiments, and he wrote about it and lots of other experiments in this book, Optics. He wrote in English very sort of anecdotally, so that anybody could do it. You can't read it from where you are, but it says, the sun shining into a dark chamber through a little round hole in the window shut, and his light there being refracted by a prism to cast his coloured image. I held a white paper to the image, and he goes on and describes what he did. But you can see here, it says the proof by experiments. And so in a way, this was a manifesto to proclaim the virtue of experimental, of empirical science. And the subtext of that was to get away from the French idea of rationalism. Descartes famously said, I think, therefore I am, and argued down logically from that. And the British approach was the Baconian approach of gathering lots and lots and lots of information and building up by induction. So this is partly a sort of pitch against the French, to say that this is the way in England, this is the way we do science. We do it by experiment, not by rational logic. So that's two things the optics had. It was a manifesto for experiment. It had long, long, long details of all the experiments he did. And at the end, it had 31 queries or questions, which were his speculations about all sorts of things which didn't necessarily have anything to do with optics at all. And I've chosen extracts from two of them in particular. They're much, much longer than this. They're several pages long. But I start with this one. Have not the small particles of body certain powers, virtues, or forces by which they act at a distance for producing a great part of the phenomena of nature? And that's the sort of what we think of as gravitational attraction. If you've got two particles and they've got some sort of innate force or power, and they pull towards each other. For a lot of people in the late 17th century, that was a completely sacrilegious idea, because they wanted a universe in which there were two kinds of entities. There was matter, brute matter, and there was spirit, God, human souls. And if you give ordinary matter the power of attraction, to attract towards each other, you're removing that firm boundary between inner matter and the spiritual power, which ultimately only belongs to God. So a lot of people immediately disagreed with Newton's theory, because it opened the door to materialism, the idea that you can produce life from inner matter. And they were very much opposed to that. So in this other query, he put forward a completely different model of gravity, in which he imagines that there's an ether all around us. It's invisible, it's weightless, you can't smell it, you can't detect it in any way. And it contains particles which endeavour to recede from one another. So they're mutually repellent, but they attract the particles of ordinary matter. And that idea that there's an ether out there and that it carries gravity, rather like sound through air, waves of gravity travel through an ether. That idea remained very important right up until the very early 20th century, when Einstein disproved the existence of an ether. Well, I'll get on to the actual book now. It's a Principia. That's the frontispiece. It was published in 1687 under the auspices of the Royal Society when Samuel Pepys was the president of the Royal Society. This is what it looks like. It's about that big, about that thick. And so this is a nice leather-bound version. Newton himself didn't particularly want to publish it. Edmund Halley, the astronomer, persuaded him to publish it. It was Edmund Halley who actually paid for it all, because the Royal Society had just produced a multi-volume book on fishes, and it wasn't selling very well. So they hadn't got any money left for books, so they certainly weren't going to invest their money in this guy from Cambridge that nobody had heard of. So Edmund Halley paid for it. When you go in, you can see it looks very different from the optics. It's in Latin, for a start. It's got lots of geometrical diagrams, and it's also set up in sections, and there's propositions, and there's corollaries, and Newton deliberately made it look like Euclid's geometry. He was an enormous fan of Euclid and also of geometry, which was the mathematical language of the Greeks, of the ancients, and he had this idea that we should go back to the Greeks, because the Greeks were the highest civilization. They had the purest form of knowledge, and everything had gone downhill basically since the Greeks, and we should try and recapture their ancient way of thinking. As I mentioned before, Newton didn't sort of come across this all on his own. He had lots of contemporaries, lots of predecessors. So I'm just going to do a sort of two-slide summary of the whole of physics before Newton. So we'll start in 1543 with Copernicus, and he put the sun at the centre. So sun, Mercury, Venus, there's the Earth with the moon going round it, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn going around that. And you can see, although he has put the sun at the centre, as I said before, lots of people thought that this was just a model, not what was really out there. And you can see he's also got circles, because this is still a model in which Copernicus believes in divine perfection. And so God would only make circles out in space. then half a century later, as Kepler showed that the planets move in ellipses. So there's the sun at the focus of the ellipse, and there's a planet moving around it. But he didn't have the notion of gravity. Kepler believed that everything was held together magnetically. So he believed in a magnetic universe, and that was one of the things that Newton argued with the Astronomer Royal about, is whether it was magnetism or gravity that was holding the universe together. So that's the sort of cosmic history. And then Galileo died in the year that Newton was born. So he was a bit younger than Copernicus and Kepler. He was doing lots of experiments on motion. This is one of his manuscripts. And he was doing all this sort of experiment. You can see their experiments with inclined planes. And he did the thought experiment of dropping a feather and a stone from the top of the Tower of Pisa, but that experiment apparently was never actually done until men landed on the moon. So that's the sort of basic state of play. Galileo was using mathematics to describe the motion of things like billiard balls. So then in the early 1980s, when Newton was at Cambridge, 1680, when Newton was at Cambridge, there was a whole series of comets, and you have to remember, there was no electric light, there was no pollution, Cambridge was tiny, the sky was really nearer than it is now, and it was really, really black, and the stars really shone out, and so if you got a comet coming across, it was really quite scary. And people often said that comets were a message from God, and that they were a sign of his displeasure at a guilty, sinful world. And Newton became very interested in these comets, and he started studying them, and he wanted to prove that the comets move in elliptical orbits just like the planets did. But he also wanted to, in a way, to make natural philosophers displace astrologers so that the power of prediction would pass into the hands of astronomers, and with that would go lots of social power and status. And he was certainly pretty ambitious. He said, I now demonstrate the frame of the system of the world. And compared with Galileo, the really crucial difference is that Galileo was talking about motion and Newton is talking about force and acceleration. So there's a big conceptual difference. Although Galileo had been using mathematics, he was only talking about things moving. And Newton, by introducing force, is talking about things moving at different, accelerating to move at different speeds. So this is the structure, the Principia, how it's set out. There's the introduction with the famous three laws of motion. A lot of people managed that and basically got stuck by the time they got to the next. Certainly by the end of book one, they were totally couldn't cope with it at all. So book one is using the laws of motion to study forces and ellipses and gravity. And then motion and resisting media, things like in air, because the things on Earth are moving in air and in water, and then the moons, the planets, and the comets. So it's these three books. Well, that was the first edition. There were a lot of criticisms. I mean, there was a lot of interest, at least from those who could understand it, which wasn't very many. But there were a lot of criticisms. So a few years later, with the help of Roger Coates, who was a mathematician at Trinity, he produced a second edition, which had quite substantial changes. So he had his preface in which he was defending this theory of gravity. And then a thing at the end, which is called the General Scholium, which is an appendix, really. It's a few pages long. And that's where he has the famous statement, hypothesis non finger, which means, I spurn all hypotheses. And this was the same message as he was giving in the optics. Instead of just sort of putting up vague theories which aren't grounded in experiment, everything must be grounded in observation and experiment. And it's also in the General Scholium that he started talking about God. And then, so that's the second edition. And then the third edition was the one that most people had. That was a painting of him that was made, I think, the year before he died, and it was engraved, and that was the frontispiece of the third edition of the Principia. And it was that third edition, which had a few changes from the second, but nothing very substantial. But it was that third edition that became very famous and went all over Europe. It's still in Latin, so it went all over Europe, And I think I always think it was a bit like Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time. I think there were a lot of gentlemen who bought it and put it on the shelves of their libraries to show how culturally and educated they were, but there's an awful lot of copies that have quite clearly never been read very closely. So those are the three editions of the Principia. Right, so I'm not going to go into the maths, I'm going to talk very briefly what the three laws are, because they're so famous. So the first law is really something that Galileo had already said, that things keep moving as they are unless something acts to change it. So if you've got a billiard ball rolling across a table, if the table were perfectly smooth, it would just go on and on and on forever, but the reason it stops is because the base on the billiard table is rough, and it's friction that stops it. The second law is about force and mass and acceleration. So if you've got a golfer, and if a golfer hits a golf ball with a certain amount of force, he hits the golf ball and it accelerates, it moves faster because the golfer has applied a force, and it whizzes off over to the edge of the golf course. If he uses the same force and hits a lorry, nothing much happens, because the lorry is so much heavier that the acceleration is absolutely tiny. The third law is that action equals reaction, and that's basically how a rocket works. The rocket sends out exhaust, and that pushes against the air, and the rocket is pushed forward. The gases are expelled, and because action equals reaction, the rocket is pushed forwards. So those are the three laws of motion. And from that, by some hocus-pocus, well, not hocus-pocus exactly, he ends up with this very famous law. It's the inverse square law of gravitation. And other people had thought of it, Hooke had thought of it, but what Newton did was show that it is always exactly true. It's not approximately true, it's always exactly true. And he also, it's quite easy to show it for point particles, but what he did was show it also applies in the situation where we've got large spherical masses like the Earth. So that's the force, and that's G, it's a constant, it's called the gravitational constant, and that's two particles with different masses, and R is the distance between them. So the bigger the masses, the greater the force. And the bigger the distance, the smaller the force, because that gets bigger, and the distance gets bigger. Did you get that? Good.
Just about.
But one very important thing is, if you consider the apple falling from the tree, it's very easy to think that it's only about the apple falling from the tree. But if you think back to the golfer with the truck, there is actually, it's a mutual interaction. There is actually a very, very, the apple is itself having a very, very, very small effect on the Earth. It's just that you don't notice it because the mass is so small, which makes the acceleration very small. And using that, Newton showed that the comets move in ellipses and are part of the solar system. So that's the Principia in 5 minutes. I'm going to sort of talk about some of the objections. People didn't always like it. One of the main criticisms was that there's no explanation. Newton says all this happens, he's got his equation, but where does it come from? So Gottfried Leibniz, the person, they had a great priority dispute about who invented calculus first, said gravity must be a scholastic occult quality. Scholastic means Aristotelian. So it's an occult quality, it's magic, it's something you've got no name for, or the effect of a miracle. And everyone kept pushing Newton for a reason, for an explanation. Because his universe was very different from Descartes. Descartes, his immediate predecessor, thought that things can only move if they hit each other. So for example, billiard balls move because you hit them with a cue. And he had this model of a clockwork universe, a mechanical universe, and the old clocks, this is the old clock on the side of the cathedral at Prague, the old clocks like that were actually, they weren't really used for telling the time, they were more a model of the universe, because the idea was that God had created a universe that worked smoothly just like a clock. But under the influence of his alchemy, Newton put forward a completely different argument. He said, that particles have got some sort of innate force. Their particles are acted on by the laws of mechanics, but they are moved by certain active principles, such as is that of gravity, and that which causes fermentation and the cohesion of bodies. So from his alchemical studies, he had this idea of a sort of living universe. And when he thought about the comets, he didn't think of them just as inert bodies. He thought of them as in having active matter in their tails, because he worked out that, according to all his theories, the motion of the planets around the sun would sort of gradually die down, go out of step with what's actually observed. So he had this idea that from time to time, God sends in a comet with some active matter in its tail to restore the universe to its original state of equilibrium. And Leibniz and lots of others didn't like that. They said he's got a very odd opinion concerning the work of God. According to their doctrine, God Almighty wants to wind up his watch from time to time, otherwise it would cease to move. He had not, it seems, God, it seems, had not sufficient foresight to make it a perpetual motion. So these debates about the role of God were absolutely central to the debates and the controversies surrounding Newton's Principia. And I mentioned earlier that when Newton introduced the general scholium of 1713, he introduced God. He says, "And thus much concerning to God, to discourse of whom from the appearances of things does certainly belong to natural philosophy." Another aspect of Descartes' system, the one that immediately preceded Newtonianism, was, I mentioned that in Descartes' universe, every cosmos, everything is touching. You can only have, something only moves because something else touches. So he imagined that at the creation, God produced loads and loads and loads and loads of tiny particles of different sizes, and they all rotate in what he called vortices or whirlpools, and they all go round and round and round and round, but they all touch each other. There's absolutely no vacuum anywhere, unlike Newton's cosmos, where you have particles with completely empty space in between and the force extending over that vacuum. So these are two images from Descartes' book. And so this is his vortices, and here's a comet sort of making its path between the different vortices. And one of the consequences, all the vortices rotate round a centre. So one of the implications of Descartes' vortex theorem is that you've got lots and lots and lots of different universes out there. And that was something that a lot of people believed in the 17th and 18th century, that God created just our universe, he created lots of other universes as well. And Newton argued against that. He said, there's only one universe. God is universal. God acts everywhere. The true God is a living, intelligent, and powerful being. He endures forever. He's everywhere present. By existing always and everywhere, he constitutes duration and space. So there's a very important sense for Newton in which the universe, the cosmos, actually is God. That they're one and the same thing. Right, so I'm going to move on to talk about the Principia and Newtonianism, the third section. This is one of the many, many, many pictures of Newton that was produced. You can see his face is on a coin, so he looks like an emperor, and also he's inside a star. There was this Renaissance belief that great heroes go up and live in the stars. So he sort of became a semi-god during the 18th century. And this is one of many popular books that were produced about Newtonianism. It's an Italian book. It's called Newtonianism for the Ladies. And it's dialogues on light, colour, and attraction. And it's like a lot of these sort of books in the 18th century. It's a dialogue between a fashionable woman and a man, and it's sort of rather flirtatious, and it comes up with awful things like, you trap me in the inverse square of the distance you are away from me, and sort of stuff like that. But it does try to explain the basic principles of Newtonianism in simple words. Because what Newton himself said is he wanted to avoid being hated by little smatterers in mathematics. So the Principia is really, really, really complicated, and not many people could understand it. And it would never have become as well known as it did if all sorts of other people hadn't translated and interpreted it. And it's got quite an interesting history. It came out in 1687 in England, and some mathematicians in England and Scotland did quite a lot of work on it, but it didn't really have much impact in Britain at all. And then it went over to Leiden. Leiden was one of the most important universities in Europe in the early 18th century. And there were Dutch experimenters there who made little models, the sort of thing with towers that don't fall over and things that look as though they're rolling up an inclined slope. They made a lot of those mathematical devices. And they wrote a book in Latin about it. And then that book was translated back into English in 1737 by this man called Desaguliers. Desaguliers was Newton's assistant at the Royal Society, and this man, Gravesander, was the man in Holland who made all these practical demonstrations, and Desaguliers built lots of little toys like that. So Newton's Principia, who came back into England, having first gone over to Holland and then come back again in Latin and then translated into English. And I picked out Desaguliers because he's a particularly important person, but there were loads and loads of people like him who taught Newtonian physics and mathematics and made it intelligible to everybody else. And he trained lots of lecturers who went out around Europe with all these little demonstration devices and explained to people what Newton's gravity was about. And during the century, other people worked on Newton's mathematical manuscripts, a lot of which weren't published during his lifetime. And this, I think, is my favourite picture in the whole of the history of science. It's an introduction to calculus, and it was written by the Lucasian professor at Cambridge in the middle of the century. And when Newton wrote the Principia, he did use the methods of calculus, but he didn't use the algebraic notation that we use now. He did everything in geometry because that was the language of the Greeks. So this is a book that's going to be sold to university students, guys about your own age, certainly not women, just men. But Oxford and Cambridge had a very bad reputation in the 18th century, so people mostly spent their time gambling and drinking and hunting, sort of, you know, completely different from what it is now. Here's these two young men out with guns, and the big selling point of Newtonian calculus is that you can work out how to shoot two ducks with one bullet. But over here, there's a group of Greek people with scrolls and things. And what the message of the frontispiece is that, yes, you can go out and you can use Newton's calculus and you can shoot your ducks and everything else, but actually, the Greeks were best. This is just a development of what happened in early Greece. So the adoption of Newtonianism in Britain was slow, but basically because Newton didn't do much to promote it, and it was very difficult to understand. Its adoption in France, and it's the only foreign country I'm going to talk about, its adoption in France was slow because England and France were at war with each other for most of the 18th century, and they had their own national hero, Descartes. So it became very much a battle between two national heroes, Descartes and Newton. And Voltaire, famous essayist and playwright, came over to Britain in the late 1720s because he was a political exile. And he wrote, "A Frenchman arriving in London finds things very different in natural science as in everything else. He has left the world full, he finds it empty." And by that he was referring to Descartes' idea that everything has to touch everything else in order to move. There's no vacuum anywhere. So that's in Paris. And he comes to London and he finds it empty. There's Newtonian gravity stretching through empty space. And in the 1730s and 40s, almost everybody in France still held to Cartesian physics rather than the Newtonian physics that had been introduced 50 years earlier. And one very important person in spreading Newtonian physics in France was this woman on the left, Emily du Châtelet. Emily du Châtelet and Voltaire lived together in one of her husband's castles for about 20 years, and the husband seemed quite happy about that and came to visit them from time to time, and that was all fine. She was an excellent mathematician, and it's this book, Elements of the Philosophy of Newton, which came out in 1738, which is often said to convince the French nation that they should go for Newton rather than Descartes. And you can see it's only got one person's name on the title page, that's Voltaire. But this is the frontispiece, and you see here's Voltaire with a laurel wreath, dressed up like a Roman scribe. And here's Newton sort of in the clouds, because by this stage it's not really quite clear whether Newton is a god or he's sort of semi-divine. So there's Newton up in the clouds, and there's a divine light coming down through Newton, and then it's going, here's the goddess of truth, and she's holding the mirror, but the goddess of truth is Emily du Châtelet. And she's casting the light, the Newtonian light, down onto Voltaire's hand. And Voltaire said, Minerva dictated and I wrote. So it's quite clear that Emily du Châtelet was contributed enormously to this book, even though it's only Voltaire's name on the frontispiece. After they'd done that, Voltaire went off and went, that was as much as he could cope with, and there's virtually no maths in it, and he went back to writing essays and plays and poetry. Emily du Châtelet, on the other hand, wrote a lot of scientific books, and in particular, she embarked on a translation from the Latin of Newton's Principia. And it's still the only complete translation in French. She went back to the original Latin because there were so many mistakes in the English translation. She also criticised Newton. There's a long, long commentary in which she points out things that he got wrong or that she disagrees with. And she also reviewed all the latest experiments. So it's much more than just a translation. It's also an interpretation. So she was the means of bringing Newtonian physics into France. And by the end of the 18th century, in France, there was this man, Laplace, who called himself the French Newton. And he famously, he was a determinist, by which he meant that he said, if you tell me at any time where everything is and how fast it's moving, I can predict, I could predict forever and ever where everything is going to be. Which is entirely different from Newton's own model of the universe. Newton's own model had God intervening by sending active matter in the tails of the comets. But, and so Napoleon, and this is probably an apocryphal tale, but Napoleon supposedly said to him, where is God in your physics? And Laplace said, sire, I have no need of that hypothesis. So the sort of Newtonianism we have now is Laplace's deterministic Newtonianism. But it's very different from the sort of Newtonianism that Newton was put forward. So it actually makes sense in a way to say, was Newton a Newtonian? And if you sort of think about sort of physics and how people think about it now, it's obviously impossible to work out where everything is going to be all the time. And that's the fundamental basis of chaos theory, the idea that a butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, all sorts of things will happen. But it is still, in principle, possible to work out what happens. That's why there's lots of computer simulations doing global warming, for example, because the idea is that everything does follow deterministic laws. On the other hand, the theories of quantum mechanics deny that and say there is a fundamental uncertainty right at the heart of the universe. According to quantum mechanics, you can never, ever, ever know everything for certain, even if you had all the physics and the maths possible available. There's an inherent uncertainty. And that was what Einstein never agreed with. When he said God doesn't play dice with the universe, at heart he wanted it to be a deterministic universe. And he was rather like the mathematicians I spoke about previously. He saw quantum mechanics as a very valuable tool for describing the universe. But he, in one sense, he was a Newtonian, and that he regarded the universe as being deterministic. So let's finish by showing you a couple of pictures of Newton. If you've been to the new British Library between St Pancras and King's Cross stations, There were going to be 12 statues in the courtyard, but they ran out of money while they were building it, so there's only one now. And it's got quite an interesting plaque on the front, because it says the money was donated by the football pools. But anyway, so there's Newton. And it's, you can see it's a very sort of angular, technological, deterministic sort of Newton. He's got great bolts through his thighs, and he's got this very angular sort of set of dividers. It's based very much on this. This is a picture by William Blake at the end of the 18th century, and I think you can see how it's the two Paolozzi has derived it directly from the Blake image. Except Blake's Newton seems to be sitting on a rock underwater. It's rather ambiguous, but there's a circle and a triangle here and a scroll, and it is often said that Blake said that Newton was trying to, through mathematics, he was trying to squeeze religion out of the universe. But, as I've tried to explain to you, Newton himself was a very religious person who was very interested in alchemy. And this is a quotation by John Maynard Keynes. Newton wasn't the first of the Age of Reason. He was the last of the magicians, and it goes on that he inherited the eyes on the world of the Babylonians and the Sumerians. And I think that's a sort of general principle of the history of science. It's very easy for us, it's very tempting for us. Newton's physics is colossally, colossally important, so we sort of go back and look and see at what it was. But for Newton himself, he didn't know that. So when you look at Newton, you have to go back and think, how did he perceive the world? What was he inheriting from his own past? And he had a track record, he learned about Aristotle at university, and Euclid, and he was steeped in the Bible, and he learned a lot of alchemy. So it was out of that that he produced this book, The Principia, which is now so famous today. Okay, I'm going to stop there.
Thank you.